I'm going to start today with a poem that I'm going to read to you. This is by Mary Oliver, the U.S. Poet Laureate from 2001 to 2003. It's called The Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? I love this poem because I hear in it the poet's desire to be attentive, to notice the tiny gifts of the day, of the season that she's in, of the life she's living. And she asks a question, right? What will you do with your one wild and precious life? It's a question that lingers longer than an afternoon lying in the grass on a summer's day. It's a question that invites reflection. It's a question that leaves us to consider, what season do we find ourselves in, and how might we make the most of it? It's a question that leads us to wonder how we might spend a life doing that. I think most of us, when we stop to recognize that we have this one wild, precious life to live, we recognize we want it to be worth something, to mean something, to be fully appreciated for what it is. Right? Honestly, none of us really know how long we have. But we do have a sense that what time we have, we want to use well. Perhaps we wonder if there are things that we might be destined for, things that we might be uniquely made for, things that could maximize our effectiveness in living well. And if there are those things, how would we find them? And if we think we found them, how do we accomplish them? How do we get the most out of them being realized? Well, I'm starting off talking about this sense of destiny, of calling, because that's the theme of our new teaching series that we're beginning, and I'm calling it Find Your Calling. And over the next couple of months, it's going to take us throughout the season of Lent, which is a season the church has often observed that leads up to Easter. We're going to be pursuing this theme together in various ways, including our Sunday teachings. What does it mean to discover our calling, our destiny, those things perhaps that we seem made to do by a loving God, and we might find joy and meaning and purpose by living into? And how are those things cultivated over the course of the various seasons of our life? Now, in our culture, there tends to be a cult of celebrity around folks who seem to get it young, say in their 20s, right? We see actors and actresses or musicians or here in the Bay, tech entrepreneurs whose stars seem to rise meteorically, right? When they're like 22 or 25. And now by 30, they're like CEO of a major company and they have $1 billion. Okay? And while none of us that I know of are billionaires, we might have all felt that kind of pressure, right? Maybe we discovered something in our 20s that felt significant, like the path, right, that maybe God was inviting us into, and we thought, okay, I get it, let's go. And we expected then that it should like go big, right? Because this is like, maybe this is a God thing, and now we're on board, so like what's the delay? Shouldn't we be living our calling like as soon as possible, if it's something we were really made to do? Well, there are some smart people in the world, researchers, folks who've studied leadership development and such, who've noted that actually it very rarely works that way. A calling or a destiny cultivated even by someone. Even when someone is like tapped into God, right, and trying to follow what God's doing in their life, it's not something that people usually arrive at in their 20s, okay? You might get the gist of the thing. You might get a sense of what it's going to be, of where you're going. But it's often not until like your 50s, if you hang in there, that you really hit the season where you're fully doing exactly what you were made to do. You're firing on all cylinders. It's working. It's fulfilling, and so on, okay? And those who do seem to get there in their 20s, researchers often point out that the thing that went big in their 20s isn't actually their real calling. It's not actually kind of the thing, right, that's going to be kind of the defining piece of their life, right? It's part of the process, maybe. But, like, I have a hunch. Say Mark Zuckerberg, for instance, at the end of his life won't say, it was all about starting Facebook. That was the most important contribution I made to the world, right? I'm guessing his life as a husband, as a parent, as a philanthropist, as a voice of influence in the larger technology sector, and the things that we don't even know are coming, those are going to be just as important, if not more important parts of his particular calling than coming up with this, you know, website when he was 20, okay? Our one wildlife goes beyond a particular decade, just as it does beyond one particular summer afternoon. But here's the thing. Success isn't guaranteed. Getting there, not guaranteed. Invitations from God, even, to take a certain path, don't just inevitably come true. We participate in our callings. We say yes. We say no. We make choices, not only to whether we're going to pursue a given vocation or ministry or life direction, but we choose all along the way how we're going to get there, what that looks like. And what a number of folks who've studied the development of leaders across the spectrum in both religious and secular spheres have noticed is that really the whole process matters. There can be a long path between finding something we might be called into and living that thing out in fullness. Okay, a path full not just of decades of life, but of different kinds of challenges, of choices, of tests that must be passed, and not everyone advances to the next round. Okay, a lot of folks get stuck along the way, where they flame out altogether and they end up frustrated, cynical, and bitter about all the empty promises of life that just never came to be for them. All the wasted potential. So the questions we're left to consider are not just, well, what are we called to? But also, how might we actually get there with Jesus? What are the steps we need to take all along the way to help us to be the people in our 40s, in our 50s, in our 60s and beyond who are actually doing the stuff that we set out to do? So today, as just a bit of a preview, just a little taste of this theme that we're going to look at over the next several weeks and an illustration of the kind of thing I'm talking about, we're going to look at the life of one character from the Bible who plays a pretty significant role in the story the Bible tells in the Old Testament, and that's King David. Now, I'm going to note, we're not looking at David because he's a perfect person or a perfect model in every way, right? Jesus is the only person really that fits that bill. But the story of David is instructive on this front because the Bible tells us his story over multiple decades, from boyhood to old age. And we can see in him these seasons lived and get a sense of how God's purposes are being developed in different seasons. And we're going to focus specifically just today on how he gets from a place of calling to actually starting to do it. Okay, we're not even going to talk about how he finishes. We're just focusing on how he even gets from the where he starts to have a sense of what it is to what he actually is starting to do, okay? Now, because David's a major character in the Old Testament, there's a lot of Jewish and Christian folks who've studied the Bible that have spent time studying him in depth. Mike Bickle is a pastor in Kansas City who spent a lot of his time in the Bible studying David, and he came up with a particular framework that I think is helpful, so we're going to kind of jump off of it. It breaks down the seasons of David's life into five main seasons. And really, this is, again, the seasons walking into the calling, okay? And each of them is set around a specific place that David lived at that time. So we're going to take some time today to explore those five cities and the seasons they represented and see what's instructive for us. Okay, so the first city we find David in is the small town he grew up in. It's Bethlehem. Okay, Bethlehem's the hometown of David. And this season of his life, we're going to give the title Small Beginnings. Okay, it's the season of small beginnings. Bethlehem's where David grew up. He comes from this small, humble town, modest means. He's the youngest son in a family of eight boys. And he's by far the lowest rung on the ladder, okay? He is stuck being the shepherd boy, okay? Now, we have a tendency in religious circles to kind of paint the shepherd in this, like, angelic, spiritual way, this humble young man like Jesus with a lamb over his shoulders. But, like, the reality of being the family shepherd was not super glamorous, okay? It was pretty rough. You had to live outside with the smelly sheep, for one, okay? You had to fend off the wild animals. You didn't get to hang out with the rest of the family on a regular basis. They're all doing their family stuff. They're having their family meals. You're outside. You're living with the animals, okay? You're stuck with the sheep. It's boring. It's lonely. It's dangerous. It's cold. You know, it's not a great job. It was usually a job given to, like, one of the least status servants, okay? But in a family of eight boys, the youngest son gets the job, okay? In this season, David is so insignificant in his family economy that when Samuel comes to call, okay, Samuel is the prophet of the nation of Israel. Samuel would have been the most famous person in the country at that point. Samuel, the prophet of Yahweh, Samuel who speaks on God's behalf to the king of Israel, Saul, Samuel who helps the people of God stay in tune with God, this Samuel comes to see David's dad, Jesse, and his family doesn't even think to have David in the room, okay? Samuel tells Jesse that he's there to anoint the next king of Israel, that one of Jesse's sons is going to fill that role. And nobody calls David. I mean, even Samuel makes assumptions. He's in the room, and he sees tall, dark, and handsome Eliab, the oldest of the eight, and he thinks, well, this has got to be the guy. I mean, look at him. But God is like, no, no. Don't judge by appearances, Samuel. Things aren't always what they seem. So Samuel takes a look at the next son. God says, no. And then the next one, God says, uh-uh. And so on and so on. Until God passes on the seventh son, and Samuel is left to wonder, well, like, what the heck am I even doing here? Does this guy have any other sons? And even Jesse, David's dad, has to be like, oh, right, I guess technically I do, but, you know, he's just the shepherd boy. I mean, you couldn't really want David. And then they bring him in the room. And God tells Samuel, yep, that little guy, that's the one. Small beginnings, okay? Now, what's the task of small beginnings? What's the purpose of this season in David's life? I think there are a couple of key things to notice. First off, in this season of small beginnings, God's beginning to cultivate a childlike faith in David, right? That takes us back to one of our Blue Ocean distinctives. Our approach to spiritual development is childlike faith. So what do I mean by that here? Well, David, in some sense, might be ignored, maybe even a little bit neglected by his biological father, Jesse. But while he's out in the fields with the sheep, he is in creation. And it speaks to him, just like it spoke to Mary Oliver. And we know this because David was an artist. He was a songwriter. He was a poet, a worship leader. Okay, a huge chunk of the songs recorded in the book of Psalms are attributed to him. And those Psalms give us a glimpse into David's character and what's going on in him. And so we see a Psalm like Psalm 19, which seems like it very likely came from that season of small beginnings where David is sleeping under the stars and just captivated by what he sees. You can read it with me. The heavens proclaim the glory of God. The skies display his craftsmanship. Day after day they continue to speak. Night after night they make him known. They speak without a sound or word. Their voice is never heard, yet their message has gone throughout the earth and their words to all the world. God has made a home in the heavens for the sun. It bursts forth like a radiant bridegroom after his wedding. It rejoices like a great athlete eager to run the race. The instructions of the Lord are perfect, reviving the soul. The decrees of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. Reverence for the Lord is pure, lasting forever. The laws of the Lord are true, Each one is fair. They are more desirable than gold, even the finest gold. They're sweeter than honey, even honey dripping from the comb. They are a warning to your servant, a great reward for those who obey them. How can I know all the sins lurking in my heart? Cleanse me from these hidden faults. Keep your servant from deliberate sins. Don't let them control me. Then I will be free of guilt and innocent of great sin. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be pleasing to you, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. It's beautiful, right? This is the song of someone who is captivated with his Creator. In this season of small beginnings, God is solidifying David's identity, not in the thing ultimately that he's going to be called to do, but in his ultimate identity as a child of God, first and foremost. Before he becomes a king, God needs David to have that childlike faith, to know God as a loving parent, to adore him, to look to him for guidance and direction, to trust him, to want to serve him like a child and their parent. But the other important task of this season is faithfulness in the mundane. Samuel anoints David as probably a teenager, 17 at the most. And then what happens? Does he move to the palace? No, he's sent back out to tend the sheep. He's just been given the news by like the wisest sage of the age that he's going to be the most powerful person in the whole country. And then he's sent back into the fields to feed animals and clean up crap, right? He's fighting off the predators. In this early phase, there seems to be a test of obscurity that needs to be passed. Can you be faithful with whatever you're doing, even when you're an obscure nobody to the world around you? Faithfulness to the small, to the mundane, seems to be an important task in this season. It was when I was pregnant with Elliot that my mentor at the time looked me in the eyes and said, Leah, I'm looking at your gifts, at the things God's put in you, and you have the gift mix of a church planter. That's what you've been made to do. You're not ultimately, you know, just a worship leader, a musician. You could start and be the senior pastor of a church. And when she said that, it was like everything made sense. It was scandalously true. I knew it in my core. You know, years before I had once heard Jesus whisper to me that someday we would start a church, but I had, you know, sillily assumed that that meant Jason would become a pastor. And in that moment, finally I got, no, it's me. It's me. And a few weeks later, I was at a conference where that was confirmed over and over, and person after person that I met prayed for me, and they all had these words blessing my leadership and inviting God to give me the courage to step into this new thing he was calling me to, and it was amazing. And this woman I'd never met named Adie spoke, and it was like I was the only person in the room, and she was speaking directly to me, and there were 1,000 people in the room. And I went up for prayer along with, you know, at least 50 women. And she asks us to put up our hands if we thought specifically God was saying he's calling us to start a church and we wanted to say yes to that someday. So I put my hand up and Adie came and she laid her hand on my head and began to pray. And God's power was so strong that my 38-week pregnant body just fell to the floor under its weight. And I couldn't deny I was being called to something real. But 2 weeks later, I was nursing a newborn baby. I was sleepless. I was changing poopy diaper after poopy diaper. And when I went back to work, it was in that season of doing 4:30 a.m. shifts at Starbucks. So changing diapers and pouring coffee, these were monotonous tasks that felt so removed from what I believed God had spoken to me. But it was, though it was frustrating, though it was mundane, I knew that was where I needed to be in that season. So I was trying to live that season with as much faithfulness and integrity as I could, though I wondered how the things God had painted on my horizon would ever come to be. Well, a little while later in David's life comes the famous story we all heard as kids. Young David, too small to even wear the armor, it says, saying, you know, slays the huge enemy Philistine giant Goliath with a single stone from his slingshot. And David's attitude in that season demonstrates the thing that God has been working on in him in that whole first season. We see it in 1 Samuel 17. I have been taking care of my father's sheep and goats, he said. And when a lion or a bear comes to steal a lamb from the flock, I go after it with a club and I rescue the lamb from its mouth. And if the animal turns on me, I catch it by the jaw and I club it to death. I have done this to both lions and bears, and I'll do it to this pagan Philistine too, for he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who rescued me from the claws of the lion and the bear will rescue me from this Philistine. So we see David's belief and trust in God as his good parent evident. And we see in the same way his confidence that God, I mean, God's done things that, you know, relatively are small. Although, I mean, I don't want to chase down a lion. But compared to this whole army standing in front of the Philistines, right? That seems impossible. But David is saying, if God can rescue my flock and me from the lion, why couldn't he rescue us, our army, from the Philistines? Why can't I defeat this giant, right? This is a theme we see recurring throughout the Bible, throughout the lives of leaders, and we're going to notice it as we go forward in this series. You might call it the little big principle, okay? God gives someone something relatively small to do, but if they're faithful with it, they're given something bigger, okay? Jesus points this out explicitly in Luke when he says, if you're faithful in little things, you'll be faithful in large ones. But if you're dishonest in little things, you won't be honest with greater responsibilities, okay? How you do with the small things matters. Well, after a season in Bethlehem, David apparently passes the test because he moves on to the next major city, Gibeah. Okay, David has his victory over Goliath, and all of a sudden he goes from being this little obscure nobody to being a real somebody. King Saul and his son Prince Jonathan, they're pretty impressed, taken with this young man. And so Saul even moves David from Bethlehem to live in Saul's palace with him in Gibeah. And we call this season early promotion. David's been faithful through the season of small beginnings. He's been faithful to the mundane. Now it's beginning to pay off. He conquered the Philistine. That's meaningful. It gets noticed. So 1 Samuel 18 tells us this. Whatever Saul asked David to do, David did it successfully. So Saul made him a commander over the men of war, an appointment that was welcomed by the people and Saul's officers alike. And when the victorious Israelite army was returning home after David had killed the Philistine, women from all the towns of Israel came out to meet King Saul, and they sang and danced for joy with tambourines and cymbals, and this was their song. Saul has killed his thousands, and David his 10,000s. So here, David moves from the test of obscurity to the test of praise. He's tested by praise. These women are praising David. Sure, King Saul is great, but David, I mean, he's the real deal. He's awesome. He's our hero. Oh, David, swoon, right? And the real question is, how is David going to handle all of a sudden becoming a real somebody? Proverbs 27:21 says this, fire tests the purity of silver and gold, but a person is tested by being praised. A person is tested by being praised. Early promotion is about continuing to work in the follower of God's heart to allow them the opportunity to experience praise, but also to keep their heart in check. Is the early promotion going to go to David's head? Is he going to lose his childlike connection to God because he doesn't think he needs his heavenly father in the same way now that he's the big cheese, right? What if the praise goes away? Will David's life still have meaning if the women are no longer swooning? Or is his sense of self becoming tied to his prestige? About a year and a half before Jason and I were planning on moving to Berkeley, everything seemed to be looking amazing, divinely promising. I went through church planting assessments with the denomination I was in, and my scores were apparently really strong. And they said, we think your Berkeley church plant's going to be great. We're super excited for you. We want to follow you, to be interviewing you along the way, to partner with you so you can serve as kind of our model of how we're going to do this with women church planters. So that seemed very promising, very exciting. In the same denomination, I was invited to serve on a national women's task force to help strategize ways to promote women in leadership across the country. I was in conversations with the music label of the group because they were potentially interested in putting songs of mine on albums that could be used in other churches across the country. It was all very exciting and felt like the things that I had been working for many years in my seasons of obscurity were finally all coming to pass. And then the denomination put forward a position that I had disagreed with on an issue that was important to me. And overnight, everything shifted. In the same way, David's fortunes changed quickly too. Saul promotes David, but when everyone becomes taken with him, he gets jealous. He's threatened by David. And so he decides he needs David out of the way, and he starts trying to have him killed. David gets wind of this, makes a run for it, and this begins a whole season where he's on the run, okay? He's hiding out, trying to escape Saul and his army. And in this season, we find that the next location, which is one of a number he actually lived in a season, but we'll use one of them kind of as emblematic of the season, Adullam. The title of this season is The Cave, because that's what Adullam is, The Cave of Adullam. I mean, talk about a turn of events, right? He goes from being a military hero, adorned by all, living in a palace, to a hunted man hiding out in mountain caves. It's quite dramatic. As he's hiding out, others start to drift to him too, mostly other criminals who are also on the run. They're the rabble-rousers, the mobster types of Israel throughout the land. They begin to gather around him. 1 Samuel 22 tells us this. So David left Gath and escaped to the cave of Adullam. Soon his brothers and all his other relatives joined him there, and then others began coming, men who were in trouble or in debt or who were just discontented, until David was the captain of about 400 men. 400 discontents living in caves. This is quite a scenario, right? So in this season, David's being tested in new ways. He's had a taste of his destiny, so close. And then just like that, it vanished. So where does that leave him? This is the test of disappointment. Is his heart going to stay soft towards God? Is he going to turn to God and connect with him in the pain of disappointment? Or is he going to turn away and stew and become cynical and hard-hearted because things haven't gone the way he had hoped? Multiple times, David has the opportunity to kill Saul. Do I not have this slide? Maybe it got messed up. It's okay. Okay. And end his misery. But he absolutely refuses to do it because David believes that Saul is God's anointed, the person he believes God has chosen to lead the nation in his time. So is disappointment going to change that attitude and wear down David's respect for God and his choices? I mean, God's anointed is actually kind of going crazy, and he's trying to kill David, who is, you could make an argument, also God's anointed. Can David hang with that? Will he allow God to bring him the kingship in his own time, or will he go after it himself by slaying Saul? And what about this crew around him? Can he lead the rabble? It's not the task he thought he was going to be given, but it's the one at hand. These are the people God seems to have given David in this season. They are following him. Will he ignore them? Will he try to chase them off? Or will he take them along for the journey and try to help them become an actual team, a united force in some way? Now, lest you think that the season in the caves was just like an unfortunate blip on the screen of David's life, and then he was back in the palace in short order, it might be helpful to know that we're not talking about, you know, a few uncomfortable weeks or months. 7 years David was hanging out in the caves, living a life on the run. It actually kind of reminds me of the central character in the current season of the uber-famous podcast Serial. For those of you who are into it, I'm a fan. This season's podcast focuses on the story of Bo Bergdahl, a U.S. soldier stationed in Afghanistan in 2009 who walked off his post, purportedly to try to draw attention to what he thought to be unsafe conditions for himself and the other soldiers, only to be captured by the Taliban and held as a prisoner for 5 years. Now, in one of the most recent episodes, we heard the story of how for the first year he was imprisoned, he was actively trying to escape and managed to do so twice before being caught and severely punished each time. But after the first year, escape not only became increasingly difficult as security was tightened around him and he was forced to basically spend 4 years living in a steel cage, but he was also physically and mentally getting weaker. Just staying alive became the task for Bo. Hearing his story, I can't help but wonder what it was like for David in that season. I mean, at least he wasn't isolated in a cage, but he had some, you know, he did have some sympathetic people, I guess, around him, even if they were kind of a mob. But I'd imagine some of that pattern of coming to terms right, with what's happening. Having to go through a process of adjustment would hold true. In the beginning, it was probably just about riding out this bad season, looking for the opportunities, scheming ways to get back in Saul's favor. But after a couple of years of that, I'd think that would get pretty old, right? And when you're into something like year four, year five, like you've got to feel aware, like Bo, that there's pretty much nothing you personally can do to change these circumstances. You cannot scheme your way out of this cave. All you can do is keep living. And for David, to try to stay connected to your good parent, try to stay connected to the truth that God is good, that he is your parent, even when nothing around you looks like it. There are a lot of laments of David, and I think a number of them in the book of Psalms came from this season. But even there, right, we see David turning to God in the cave. He might be angry. He might be asking, why? How could you do this to me? But he keeps talking to God. He's staying connected. Well, in the same way that eventually Bo was miraculously rescued and his 5 years of torture came to an end, so too did David's fortunes eventually turn. Saul was killed in battle, and suddenly, after 7 years of David being in hiding, some of the people of Israel remember him. They remember his leadership, they remember his promise, and they turn to him. And the same generals, some of the same generals who were chasing David at Saul's direction, come to him and say, lead us, you are God's anointed. And this leads us to the next city in our journey with David, Hebron. Hebron is the fourth season for David, the season of partial fulfillment. When the leaders of Israel start to look to David, it feels like this could be the moment, right? This could be destiny. Maybe he should storm Jerusalem. Take it now. Jerusalem is like the capital of the entire nation. From there, you could theoretically make a play to rule the whole kingdom. But they have yet to have a king set up rule in Jerusalem. No one's quite done that. So it's not totally clear the whole nation's ready for it. And Saul has a son that's actually still alive. So some might see him as the rightful heir. It's not obvious to everyone that it should be David. So David turns to his good parent, Yahweh, for direction on how to proceed. And we see it in 2 Samuel 2. After this, David asked the Lord, should I move back to one of the towns of Judah? Yes, the Lord replied. Then David asked, which town should I go to? To Hebron, the Lord answered. So David and his wives and his men and their families all moved to Judah, and they settled in the villages near Hebron. Then the men of Judah came to David and anointed him king over the people of Judah. Okay, so here's the thing you need to know about the nation David is being called to lead. It consists of what was once 12 tribes, okay? Basically descendants from the 12 sons, okay, of Israel. And they're 12 regional portions of the kingdom that belong to those tribes. David is from the tribe of Judah, okay? And he's asking God where to go. Now, if he goes for Jerusalem, which is technically in Judah, though, he could potentially make a play for the whole 12, the whole kingdom, right? But God's telling him not to go there. He's telling him to go to Hebron, which at the time was the capital of just Judah, okay? So just the one tribe that he's from. So David finally becomes a king, probably a lot later than he initially imagined it would be, but it's only for 1/12 of the kingdom he was expecting. Okay? Why? In this season, God seems to be testing David's restraint. Can he trust God's timing? Will he try to take things for himself? Does he think ultimately this is his to do? Or will he wait for God to move in God's time? Will he allow God to continue to set the pace and the agenda for how David's calling will play out? Will he continue to be faithful, whatever the task at hand? Well, David does it. He stays there in the place of restraint, ruling just Judah from Hebron, until at last, a number of years later, God moves him into the fifth and final season, Jerusalem, the season of destiny. The son of Saul is eventually killed. And there are some other political things that take place over which David has no control. These are circumstances he cannot take credit for. He didn't make it happen. But amidst them, this happens in 2 Samuel 5. Then all the tribes of Israel went to David at Hebron and told him, we are your own flesh and blood. In the past, when Saul was our king, you were the one who really led the forces of Israel. And the Lord told you, you will be the shepherd of my people Israel. You will be Israel's leader. So there at Hebron, King David made a covenant before the Lord with all the elders of Israel, and they anointed him king of Israel. David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years in all. He had reigned over Judah from Hebron for 7 years and 6 months, and from Jerusalem he reigned over all Israel and Judah for 33 years. The elders come to David. He doesn't go to them. He's not doing the political quid pro quo behind the scenes to win people to his side. He's not doing that. The leaders of the nation know they want to be united. They understand in this moment that God has chosen a person long ago, over 20 years ago, when he was just a scrawny teenager, that God told the great prophet Samuel that this now 30-something-year-old man would someday be their king. And the people realize that now is the day they need him. And David finally understands that too. This was never about him. The whole journey God has taken him on has made that clear. David's call to lead the nation of Israel wasn't really about David at all. It was about God's purposes for his people. And at that point, it becomes clear for David that he is king, not by his own doing, but because of what God has been and is continuing to do. God has given David a role to play, a significant role to play, sure. But ultimately, David isn't there because he's so cool. God wants someone who understands his identity as God's child and has the heart of a servant, someone who's willing to play the role because his God has asked him to, because he trusts this God knows what his people need, and he wants to see those purposes fulfilled, but not because he's God's gift to the world. And that's a really important distinction. The lesson David has finally learned by the time he reaches his destiny is the lesson of being something for others. And this is our lesson to learn too. So we'll be exploring in the weeks to come. Each of us is called to unique things. Throughout these next couple of months, we're going to be considering what those things might be and how God might be moving in our lives like he moved through the seasons of David's life to bring them to pass. But ultimately, whatever our specific calls are, the bigger call we are all made for is to be something for others. Our calls are not for each of us. They're about uniting us to our human family. They're about uniting our human family to its loving parent. They're about seeing the redemption of creation come to pass bit by bit as Jesus moves in the world around us. They are about following in the footsteps of the very Jesus who, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage, but rather he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant. Just like David, who called himself God's servant. This is the call on each of us, and this is the call on us, on Haven, as a community. So as we end tonight, I just want to invite you to stand with me, and we're going to take a moment where I'm going to pray a blessing over you and our community. As we embark on this season of allowing Jesus to speak to us more clearly about the things that he's calling each of us into and the things he's calling Haven into in the weeks and months and years and decades to come. And I think we stand sometimes just to acknowledge, like, we're involved. It's an active thing. It's not a huge active thing, but it's something. So Jesus, we say we want to be the kind of people who stay faithful in the little things and see you develop more and more in us. We want to be the kinds of people who have a sense that they are connected to your purposes, that what we're doing with our one wild life matters, and that it can be connected to something much bigger than whatever brief number of days we have. And Jesus, we trust that truth, that ultimately the things you're inviting each of us into connect us to your purposes of being something for others. Would you use this season to speak to us? Would you begin it even now? As we worship, I ask that you would be stirring in every heart here, that folks would sense the pieces, the places where you've already spoken, as well as a quickening, a sense of stirring around the things that you're beginning to speak now. We ask for insight into our own seasons. Help us to see where you've been working in our past, where you're working right now, where you might be working in our days to come. Amen.